Hello and welcome to the Culture File Weekly with me, Luke Clancy, and sitting here next to me, a selection of only the very finest audio coping strategies. And for this final week in July, it's mostly about learning to live in peace with the machines. In just a minute, singers of the Seamus Ennis Arts Centre find joy in Zoom. Later, composer and Dawn of MIDI mainstay Kasim Naqvi introduces us to more joy in the form of modular synthesizers. Maurice Gohan uses Take That to think through the second wave, and composer Jennifer Walsh looks back on our silent spring. But first, the worldwide warble as we click through to the Seamus Ennis Art Centre's online singing home. Back in the old world before the spring, traditional singer and producer Mac Darragh Yates helped organise regular events such as the legendary Dublin Session the night before Larry got stretched, with all comers, including singers from new folk acts such as Lancome and Landless, sharing a song. But when the pandemic hit, events needed a refit. Yates began an experiment to see how he might take his singing meetups to Zoom. Not only did the plan work, it actually presented plenty of advantages over the bricks and mortar night out, from allowing a global band of participants to adding a new sonic patina to creating a fresh kind of online intimacy, as Mac Darragh Yates told Culture File's Louise McMahon.
One starry night, as I lay sleeping, one starry night, I lay in my bed.
I always had traditional singing in my life to some extent. From a really young child, I recall like being on the streets in East Wall, where I grew up in the North Inner City, and kids would sing songs that I later would understand were child ballads. There was bits of it in my home, every family gathering, there were songs of some form, not always traditional, but sometimes traditional. I've begun to engage in the traditional singing community in various different ways, with different festival programs, projects I've sort of put on myself. And when the pandemic happened, there was an instant vacuum. How on earth are we going to socialize? How on earth are we going to practice our niche little interest?
What brings you into my room, to my room, to my room?
A lot of people who sing traditional songs are older people, and for many people it's the only time of the week they get out of the house. They're not just great singers, but they're connections to an older art form. And for these people not to have this time in the winter of their lives to be out of the house, and who knows, if this goes on for a year, 2 years, that's a massively vital amount of time we could have lost with who are, in my opinion, our national treasures.
Oh, Dan, me dear, you're welcome.
So I just started to get kind of worried about what these people were going to do in the absence of pubs being open and places to sing songs.
Thank you, ma'am.
When the Inishowen Traditional Singers Weekend was cancelled, which for me was a huge blow because it's literally the highlight of the traditional singing calendar every year, I was particularly upset. And a friend of mine, Michael Steen from Portland, Oregon, who's also planning on traveling to Ireland to go to the festival, approached me and says, why don't we do something on Zoom? That was maybe 5 days before the proposed date for the Inishowen COVID-19 conference call singing session. We set it up and did it, and it was a huge success. Within a week, every club in Ireland was doing one. Fast forward, the Seamus Ennis Arts Centre see what we're doing with that session and with other sessions and says, hey, would you come along and do one for us?
Bernie, are you there?
Okay, yeah.
Have you got a song
yeah.
in?
Yeah, I'll do Frank Hart's song, The Iron Exile.
Gorgeous.
And hopefully you can hear me without the wind. The wind is blowing down the chimney here and something desperate.
What we've done with each session is try and mimic the format of a normal in-person session.
There's not enough food.
In a normal evening of singing, say in the Cobblestone or in the Goline or any of these pubs, a healthy number of people you might get to in an evening is maybe 35 in a 3-hour session. The way Zoom have it is you can have a max of 100 participants. We don't like to close the door to anybody. We like to allow people to sign up and come along to the sessions as much as they like. But when you've got 100 people in a conference call, you're not going to get to everybody. Sadly.
But the landlady's simple and friendly. She makes up for the damp on the wall. She makes up for the damp on the wall.
I make a business at the top of the Seamus Ennis Arts Centre sessions, for example, to say,
if you were here last month, right, and you didn't get to sing last month, there was maybe 5 or 6 people who were left out, can you hit the raise your hand button on the side there? Use the chat down the bottom here
I always like the sort of function of a guest spot in a session to sort of go, well, we're all singing, and here's an example of a really great singer, and we're not going to just hear one song from them. We're going to hear several songs from them and see how they string a set together.
It's a song called I'd Rather Be Tending My Sheep.
Guests like Ian Lynch from Lancome, who was a really early guest and an early committee member of The Night Before Larry Got Stretched. Guests like Nelny Cronin, the wonderful Shannon singer from the Muskrigultucht, and also Muireann Nic Eolaithe.
You may have to unmute yourself, Muireann.
Famously of Danu and now just as a solo artist.
Muireann, do we have you?
Hi. How are you? Can you hear me?
We can hear you loud and clear.
Zoom obviously has drawbacks, right? So audio quality can be questionable. People's webcams can be of varying qualities. You know, maybe 5 years ago, the idea that 100 people could all meet in a quote-unquote conference room online and sing songs to one another was a far-off dream. The idea that we can do it now, it's something we almost take for granted. I shudder to think what lockdown, at least for me and for other traditional singers, would have been like without this lifeline. Anybody who joins in would be majorly surprised at how much you can communicate through a choppy signal and through video quality. And sometimes you barely notice. It's like you're in a room with somebody. In a pub, your sight lines necessarily mightn't be all that good. You know, you could be shoved in a corner somewhere. The amazing thing about Zoom is the camera's right in front of someone's face. You have this intimate, like, first-person view of everybody who's singing a song in a way that you mightn't otherwise. So it's got its drawbacks, but it can be strangely more personal.
Okay.
Irlo Linnard talks about the family of singers, people that don't know each other, that are kindred spirits, and they come together and they have this shared bond. It's been particularly interesting to know how that intimacy isn't lost on Zoom, right? A good singing weekend usually is full of much laughter and much tears and everything in between on the emotional spectrum. And I've seen all of that occur on Zoom. Singing can be very nostalgic for some people. It can remind them of their parents and their grandfathers and whatever else. And that all comes through. There has been a massive call within the community for Zoom sessions to continue regardless. Can this replace an in-person session? I don't think so, but it can have distinct advantages.
And I thought you were.
Anybody who joins in will realize just how much it can give in a time when nobody can get out to a pub.
Forever. But now I found.
MacDara Yates and his singing family there with songs and stories from the Zoom Room. The Seamus Ennis Arts Centre's online traditional singing sessions run on the first Friday of every month until September. The next instalment on August 1st features the aforementioned Nelny Cronin as a special guest. The live stream is viewable on the Seamus Ennis Arts Centre's YouTube channel and tseac.ie for information on how to join in. Now, how is a pandemic like a 90s boy band? Actually, the similarities are pretty obvious in terms of R and innocent lives. So a more interesting question might be, what does game theory have to do with Gary Barlow? Now, that's a question that only writer and comedian Maurice Gohan could answer. So here she is.
We're all having the time of our lives, going out for poached eggs and avocado toast and kissing our grandparents. But as we skip down the green corridor of life, looming on this happy picture is the threat of that pesky second wave. The coronavirus reunion. Remember when Take That came back without Robbie? It's going to be like that. oh, this is going to be terrible. Robbie's not here? So bad. I won't even listen. Oh, wait, that's actually a banger. Hold on. Was Robbie not the glue? They can come up with absolute hits without him. This is amazing. This is better than the original. Except invert that. Remember when we all fought over toilet paper? Remember when a bunch of celebrities sang Imagine from their mansions to cheer us up? It seems like a lifetime ago. What will be the toilet paper of the second wave? Take that, CDs.
Just have a little patience.
And how likely is a second wave anyway? I've mentioned before, I studied game theory. It's about the probability of things happening. And look, I was a terrible student. I did below average. One time I tried to get out of a failed test by pretending I had temporarily gone blind. But I wrote my thesis on ISIS, and I created a model for the likelihood of another terrorist attack in France. And that was back when they were attacking France. I published my thesis in 2016, and ISIS haven't really done much since. I'm not saying the correlation is causation, but I'm definitely implying it. I destroyed ISIS. So, I think I'm the right person to tackle this problem. COVID is like the ISIS of the virus world. Ruthless and violent and hard to catch. And both were created by the CIA. I've read some blogs, alright? Now, game theory at its essence is a two-player game. We have player A and player B. Let's say Robbie Williams and Gary Barlow, circa 1996. Both have two moves they can make. Sing in harmony or break millions of girls' hearts.
Whatever I said, whatever I didn't mean it. I just want you back for good.
Player A makes a move, and at the same time, player B makes a move, not knowing what A will do. And game theory is analysing all the strategies and outcomes possible to these two players. Now, this game does depend on everybody being rational. And people aren't rational, but governments usually are. The present American government being an obvious exception. But the US doesn't even need to worry about their second wave. They're still in the throes of the first. So, is the virus rational? Exceptionally so. If the government and the virus are in a game together, we can predict the virus's moves 100%. It's always going to attack. It doesn't matter what move the government plays, the virus is always going to choose attack. So knowing that, the government then decides its course of action, which is the result that will be the best if the virus attacks. Okay, so far, so half making sense. But we forgot about another agent. People. The people governments reign over. So really it's a three-player game. And people are irrational. People aren't that smart. They make mistakes and they make choices that are illogical and not in their best interest. So even though the virus will always choose attack, we're not going to choose something that will minimize the damage of that attack. We're going to choose no masks and holidays abroad and drunken night in crowded bars because we're human. So, maths doesn't matter here. Models don't matter. Green lists don't matter. The level of war doesn't matter. The second wave is coming.
Oh, yeah.
And I just hope Gary Barlow is ready to sing.
I guess now it's time that you came back.
Maurice Gohan there on her less than fond hopes for a coronavirus reunion. Kasim Naqvi is a composer who, bang on a can commissions notwithstanding, is best known as part of the oddball piano trio Dawn of MIDI. Dawn of MIDI played electronic-inspired music on acoustic instruments, and something of the same spirit remains in Naqvi's solo music. He's since been working with modular synthesizers, a kind of Lego kit of electronic music making, and letting the machines once more drive his sound, creating two albums from the chaos of wires and knobs. Jobs, Teenagers from 2019, and a new collection, Beta. Culturefile went, in the new style, to meet Kasim in his apartment in Brooklyn, New York, on a sultry July day. When you stopped working with Dawn of MIDI, you concentrated on your own music again. Something that particularly took up your time were modular synths. I'm hoping you'll give us the Modular Synths 101 today. I think that when I hear Dawn of MIDI's music, I hear the influence of that kind of electronic music. But maybe, like, you played it as a trio, so maybe that wasn't what came out in the end. Was there a way you were using modular synthesis in composition and then playing with more traditional instruments?
That's actually sort of what I was doing, you know, and that's my sort of approach with the modular synthesizer, because I have this kind of background in writing for, you know, ensembles and chamber groups and orchestras. I kind of wanted to treat the synthesizer like an ensemble. I usually write a lot of the music beforehand, and then I feed the compositions into the system. And then all of the tweaking and attenuation of voltage and, you know, use of frequencies and sequencers and all that stuff is like almost like an act of kind of orchestrating material that is almost like a piano reduction, you know, and then you feed it into this machine and then it expands into something else, you know.
Tell us about the machine for people who've never used a modular synthesizer. What's the essence of what's happening there?
So, you know, with the modular synthesizer, you know, you have your sort of normal type of synthesizer, right? You know, which is, you know, a keyboard, and it's in this frame with all these knobs and things that do different with filters and presets and all these sorts of things. And that's sort of the standard kind of like out-of-the-box synthesizer that we're used to. But with the modular synthesizer, you can basically assemble a synthesizer with different modules. So you can kind of pick and choose, you know, based on the kind of sound that you're looking for, you can kind of assemble this system that's comprised of different units.
So there are essentially two ways of doing that. One is sort of fills up your bedroom, and the other sits on your laptop. Like you there is modular synthesis and modular synthesis. Which is yours?
I'm trying to keep everything within my. I have a Eurorack like travel case, and I'm trying to keep everything inside of that case, and have it not expand, you know, to my like the entire living room. But it's difficult, you know. I'm definitely like, it's starting to spill out. I'm like buying more modules. It's a weird, it's like a very addictive kind of musical venture. The first module I bought was an oscillator, which is the thing that actually makes the sound. I bought that, and then I bought something called a random sampling module, which is basically a module that creates a random voltage, which then kind of gets sent out into the system to create this sense of like shakiness or kind of chaos. It reminded me a lot of writing for groups. But instead of a group, it's this electrical sort of machine. I was able to transport some of that thinking that goes into writing a piece of music. It felt kind of seamless to kind of translate that thinking into writing for the modular synthesizer. Because that type of device, it has a kind of unstable sort of nature to it, which almost makes it feel like you're interacting with another musician, you know, that's interpreting your ideas and giving you a sort of a response of its own. And then at the same time, you're kind of guiding it and conducting it.
So it's a kind of way of adding a kind of useful randomization into the sound.
Yeah, exactly. And I guess that's sort of the thing with, you know, generative music, I guess, you know, which is the term that's often used to describe the way like a modular synthesizer behaves, you know. You're kind of setting a musical kind of sequence in motion, observing its responses. And then all the while you're sort of there, just sort of tweaking it and sending it in other sort of, you know, deviations or directions. Because it's all analog, it never quite stays in tune perfectly, which is something that I like. There's a whole tuning process that I find to be very musical when you turn the system on. Because a lot of the oscillators are they're analog that I use, there's a really interesting treatment of harmonics and the overtone series. And that's something that I find to be very beautiful, and something that in some ways kind of just distinguishes the modular synthesizer from a lot of, like, you know, software synths and things that are created digitally, is that it's very much taking the harmonic series into consideration. And then you can do a lot of really interesting things in terms of, you know, how you modulate those parameters. I've been doing some stuff lately where I write music and I feed it into the synthesizer, and then I try to rewrite what the synthesizer did for acoustic instruments, you know. So there's this one project that hopefully will be happening at the end of the year in London. It seems doubtful at this point, but it's like it's an orchestra piece. So I'm sort of doing that with this work. It's like recomposition. It's untitled at the moment, and I've just started writing it, but it was going to be part of this unclassified series at South Bank, which is it's like a live performance program with Elizabeth Alker and André de Ridder, the conductor. And they'd asked me to write something new for it. But then the pandemic happened, you know, so.
Kasim Naqvi there, and his new album Beta is on Erase Tapes Records and also available from Bandcamp. And finally on the Culture File Weekly, an end-of-term report from a creator in a crazy time. For her latest audio letter from London, composer and artist Jennifer Walsh has been thinking about some of the turns, twists and curves life and art have taken since March 2020.
Back in March, I spent a lot of time looking at graphs. Each morning, I would track where we had been, where we were, and where we were headed, tracing my finger over dotted lines that projected into possible futures. You might say there was an exponential increase in the time I spent looking at exponential curves. In late March, there were missives from Italy, letters from Italians writing across time and space to tell us what the future would look like. I watched devastating footage from hospitals in Cremona, and each morning I watched the lines on the graphs continue their upward rise, tracking towards that future. A few weeks later, when the lines on the graphs had not only led to that grim future, but exceeded it, there were no scenes from the hospitals where I lived. I could only remember watching the Italian hospital footage several weeks in the past, knowing at the time that that was probably our future and that now it was our present, even if we couldn't see it, even if we only heard it described by our friends who had to go to the hospital. All this time, slowing down and speeding up and displacing. Did I see my family last week or last month or a decade ago? Recently, I had to travel to Germany to teach at my university there. Yes, the universities there are open. There is face-to-face teaching, something which many universities here in the UK don't anticipate returning to until January. In Stuttgart, people were out at restaurants and cafes, visiting the museums and theatres that have been open for several months, planning their summer holidays. I found the whole trip surreal. It felt like being in the past and the future simultaneously. In a country which had lifted restrictions, London was still weeks or months away from lifting. I came back to London into a 14-day quarantine, and all of a sudden, I was back to late March when the lockdown began, without the benefit of a daily exercise outing. I stuck to it. I counted the days of the quarantine down, and then shortly before the end of my quarantine, the government got rid of it, and I was unexpectedly free. I'm a musician and I travel a lot, so I'm used to jet lag. I'm used to that feeling of waking up at 3 a.m. in New York or wherever, waiting for my soul to catch up with my body. But now I feel a new type of jet lag, restriction lag. And it strikes me that this is what we've all had to learn to live with, how we've had to learn to live over the last months, as we sit here, awake in the night, waiting for our souls, carrying wipes and sanitizer and gloves and masks to catch up with our bodies. And what counts is that we're not alone in this, that we do it together.
Jennifer Walsh there, and she, like the rest of Culturefile, will be back later in the year. And that brings to a close this edition of the Culturefile Weekly. The Daily Culturefile is on a little break from next week, but the Culturefile Weekly will continue, and there'll be a chance to hear the complete set of Culturefile debates starting next Friday at 7 here on RTE Lyric FM. Till then, bye now.